For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. I'm your host, Red Sail, and this week, as April showers us with relentless rain, Marion Rankin unfurls her History of the Umbrella.
And it was sort of a combination of all these things sort of led me down this sort of path of inquiry. And the further down the rabbit hole I got, the worse it became.
Listener John Banfield reveals how a classic tale of imprisonment and escape inspired him to write his own memoirs.
So he said, "Dad, you've got to put all these adventures in a book." And I said, "OK, then."
And historian Lucy Worsley reveals why she thinks Jane Austen failed to find success in her own lifetime.
He sent off one of these books to a publisher who just turned it down flat.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. Practically every household has at least one, but it may not be the one you actually purchased, and you may be destined to lose it or muddle it up with someone else's the next time you go out. The umbrella is ubiquitous, and it has a surprisingly rich history, as I found out when I spoke to Marion Rankin, the author of Broliology, A History of the Umbrella in Life and Literature. Marion Rankin, welcome to Read On.
Thank you for having me.
It's a fascinating history of the umbrella. I had no idea how it's been a companion to human beings for millennia. What led you to write the book in the first place?
It was a combination of things. I was walking in the rain one day, and I'd recently visited an exhibition at the Barbican called The Rain Room. It was on sort of in the winter of 2012 to 2013. And if you didn't go, it was basically a group called Random International installed a rainstorm in the Curve Gallery at the Barbican. And the sprinklers in the rainstorm were carefully calibrated so that as soon as a person walked under it or put any part of themselves underneath it, the rain would automatically stop. So you could actually navigate this entire field of quite heavy rain without getting wet. And it just really sort of brought home the idea of what umbrellas do, I suppose. And it was quite an uncanny experience because obviously in this scenario at the Barbican, you weren't umbrellaed, and yet you were sort of your own umbrella in a manner of speaking. And it was quite surreal not even being able to sort of reach out and test the rain as you normally would when you're sort of checking whether you need an umbrella or not. And I'd just read a few books recently that had some wonderful literary umbrellas in them. And it was sort of a combination of all these things sort of led me down this sort of path of inquiry. And the further down the rabbit hole I got, the worse it became. So it ended up becoming a book.
Umbrellas began life as sunshades and ceremonial items. I hadn't realised before you told me that there is actually an Egyptian hieroglyph of an umbrella, which means shade. So they've evolved into what we use them for nowadays, haven't they?
Yeah. So as you said, they were sort of born, as it were, in sunny climates. But in England, when they finally arrived here, it was discovered that they were far more useful in the rain. Other parts of the world certainly use them as rain shelters as well. Certainly in parts of Asia, they would have found them very useful for the kind of monsoonal downpours you can get. But yeah, they've sort of undergone this fascinating transition from being very sort of revered objects connected with kingship and divinity, to the really quite prosaic objects we know today. I mean, I don't think umbrellas hold anything like the sort of status that they used to hold millennia ago, even a few hundred years ago in this country. They tend to be more sort of disposable, disheveled, battered objects that aren't very well made, and you can just throw them out after one gust of wind.
My sighted children were telling me that there are lots of pictures in the book of rather sorry-looking umbrellas poking out of bins and boxes and so on and so forth.
Being London, They do just seem to pop up everywhere. So I grew up in Australia, and the country has quite strict anti-littering laws. So the pavements are always very clear, and waste disposal from businesses is all done sort of in alleyways out the back and car parks and so on. So it was quite a shock when I moved to London and found that you have to navigate the city streets with a mind to all of these rubbish bags everywhere waiting for collection on the pavement. And it wasn't long, as soon as I started thinking about umbrellas, it wasn't long before I realised that they were just, you know, being left all over the place along these big piles of commercial waste.
Now, the structure of the umbrella, its shape and construction, hasn't really changed very much over the 3 or 4 millennia that you chart its history.
No, it's that's something I find quite fascinating about it, because so many other objects that we've been using for anything like that period of time have undergone radical transformations. So I kind of love that aspect of timelessness about the umbrella. It just has this element of being a very old object stuck in our very modern lives.
So umbrellas, when they first came to Britain, were very much only used by women and incredibly cumbersome, you tell us.
Early British umbrella design was not the most radical feat of engineering. I'm sure it was for the day, to be fair. But early umbrellas were, they were made of whalebone, which is actually a very fragile material, especially when it's being wet and dried. You have to dry it very carefully or the whalebone can crack. They didn't have the hinge mechanism at the top of the post. So essentially you had all of these spokes strung along a wire, and it just kind of clamped to this post. So they could very easily become disordered and tangled and get in all sorts of messes. And the fabric that they were made with tended to be sort of a very heavy oiled cotton, which tended to absorb nearly as much water as it repelled. So by the end of a shower, you were left with this very, very heavy, wet, dripping kind of thing that you then had to carry around for the rest of the day. So people found them quite irritating, understandably.
Then the introduction of steel spokes really made a difference as to how ubiquitous they became.
It did indeed, yeah. So there was this, it was called Fox Frame. It was a pioneering design, actually modelled off the architecture of a tubular bridge that involved, as you said, steel and hollow tubes. So that reduced the weight quite considerably. Gradually, over time, they became more and more accepted, and then eventually, they got to the point where they became almost indelibly associated in the popular imagination with the British, and particularly sort of the British middle and upper classes, very straight and proper and distinguished objects.
And you devote quite a bit of time to saying how much of an indicator of social class they were and how people were judged by the quality of their umbrellas.
Yes, that was something that I had never imagined. I sort of grew up in Australia, didn't know a great deal about sort of social classes of Britain, and certainly not the kind of meaning making that could be attached to these objects, and I found that particularly fascinating. So there were, as umbrella design sort of improved, there were different, you could almost call them levels of umbrella. So the most expensive ones would have been made of silk, and they tended to be, obviously they could roll up much thinner than a one made of cotton or alpaca wool was used as well as a covering. And sort of how your umbrella looked was a very clear indicator of sort of your social standing and also your caliber as a person. There were these guides that were printed to how to correctly roll your umbrella, how to be, you know, suitably gentlemanly with your umbrella deportment. And there's a very telling moment in E.M. Forster's book Howards End, where the kind of driving characters in the story, Leonard Bast, he has an umbrella which is taken during a concert by a much wealthier person. And his umbrella is just in this appalling condition. Seams are all gone. It's really battered, and it's very telling of his standing in society, because it's made very clear that he obviously can't afford to get his umbrella repaired or recovered and restored to its sort of former beauty.
And a lot of the plot of Howards End actually hinges on that very umbrella. You also point out that umbrellas make appearances in literature, especially English literature, across the centuries. Dickens, I understand, was quite keen on them.
I think it's over 120 references to umbrellas across his work. He wrote more than one essay about them. And they appear in most of his novels. Obviously, one of the more famous examples would be in Martin Chuzzlewit, character, sort of an alcoholic nurse and midwife called Mrs. Gamp, carries this fairly obtrusive umbrella, which is always terrorising other people and getting itself caught around people's windpipes and poking into their shins in carriages, and it's always accompanying her, and it's very symbolic of her personality as well. There are other ones in other works that carry sort of phallic sexual connotations. He wrote this absolutely beautiful essay called "Please to Leave Your Umbrella," and in it he explores this idea that the umbrella is almost the repository of all that makes oneself. He has this concept of leaving one's umbrella behind at the the entrance to a building. Also, it is a symbolic act where you actually put aside a lot of what makes you yourself, and you leave this with your umbrella as you walk into a building and take on all the sort of social codes and conducts associated with that building and that sort of dedicated space, whether it's parliament or a court or a gallery, where you're supposed to kind of take on this persona and leave a lot of what makes you an individual at the door with your umbrella.
It's very interesting, that concept of, you know, the umbrella speaking for you and being so revealing of somebody's character. And it's not just in British culture, is it? You devote some time to the umbrella in Japanese culture, and it's an evil spirit in some Japanese books, isn't it?
So in Japanese culture, there's this class of sort of spirits and demons called the yokai, monstrous beings, and there's all kinds of weird and wonderful creatures in that family. And within this group of monsters, there's a subgroup called the Tsukumogami, and they are characterized by being sort of everyday household objects which have been sort of abandoned by their owners. They've fallen into disrepair or disuse, the sorts of things you find collecting in broom closets and in the backyards. And after, I think it's sort of 99 or 100 years, they become sentient. So they actually start terrorizing their former owners and kind of moving around the world as these monstrous human creations and human abandonments that are almost slightly taking revenge for their neglect. And one of these objects is the Kasa Obake, which is an umbrella. It came about in the, I think, in the Edo period in Japan, so a few hundred years ago, and it was originally a rice paper parasol. So a very, very spindly affair. It was characterized typically by having one foot instead of the pole of the umbrella. It had a sandal, one or two eyes, and a big lolling red tongue, and it would hop about, sort of terrorizing people.
Having read that there are 35,000 abandoned umbrellas in London Underground's Lost Property Office, I can only dread to think what could happen if they were all to become sentient and go on the march.
Indeed, it really captivated me, this idea of almost the revenge of consumerist culture. All the things we throw away coming back to life and haunting us in this way. It seems very appropriate for modern times.
Why do you think umbrellas have become so disposable?
Oh, I'd say that's a lot to do with general culture of making disposable, cheaply manufactured disposable objects. It's sort of happened across the field of useful everyday objects. We've got disposable plates, cutlery, all kinds of things. And obviously that culture of sort of planned obsolescence and designing things on purpose that won't last because then you have to pay money to get another one. I think it's got a lot to do with that. Umbrellas certainly They can be made with a lot of the care and attention that they used to be, but obviously, I guess in a sort of perverted sense, it makes a lot more sense to make a terrible one for a very small amount of money and just perpetuate this cycle of people buying more and more umbrellas. And it's a real shame because not only is there a huge element of waste involved in that, but there's also this loss of sort of care and attention and craftsmanship that goes into a really well-made umbrella or any object for that matter.
And do you have a much-loved umbrella that you carry around with you all the time?
I do, actually. I didn't when I started writing. I was very much of the school of owning what umbrella came my way and then probably leaving it behind somewhere and letting the cycle continue. So I never really considered myself an umbrella owner, more an umbrella minder. But I do now have a couple of cherished umbrellas, actually. When I left my job last year, my colleagues all banded together to buy me this absolutely gorgeous umbrella from James Smith & Sons, which is a wonderful shop in Bloomsbury in London, which has been around since the early 1800s. And they still make umbrellas to the same sort of standards that they did back in the time. So they have all sorts of beautifully wrought carved umbrella heads and tassels and all kinds of things. So I've got a couple of those, and I live in constant dread that I'm going to lose them.
Well, it's a fascinating history of the umbrella and its place in our life and literature over the years. No plans for an audiobook yet, but I think we actually have found the ideal person. One of the narrators here is called Madeline Brolly. And I think your publisher really should approach her to make the audiobook version.
Absolutely think they should. How appropriate.
Marion Rankin, thank you so much for opening my eyes to the history of the umbrella and for coming into the studio and telling us these fascinating facts about it.
Thank you. It's been a treat.
Thanks to Marion Rankin, who will be back at the end of the show with the books of her life. Brolliology is out now in paperback and as an ebook, and let's hope that an audiobook version gets put up soon.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly liked The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway in the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S. was fond of yellow. It's the papal colour, and was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the talking books because, Well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Lucy Worsley has some surprising news about the portrait of Jane Austen on the new £10 note. But before that, here at Read On, we love to hear what you're reading and how you're accessing your books. You can email us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Contact producer Robert via Twitter @talking_books or ring the Connect Community Engagement Team on 0303 1234 555. Someone who did just that is John Banfield, who was keen to describe how a book that he read when he was recuperating in hospital had inspired him to write his own memoir. John Banfield, welcome to Read On.
Oh, thank you very much, Raymond.
The book starts right at the very beginning with you being evacuated from London during World War II as a baby.
It was indeed, yes. And my twin, I've got a twin brother, Philip, and we lived in London with my mother. The war had already started, so we got evacuated when we were 6 months old, and we went to, of all places, Henley-on-Thames, which is the most leafy area on the Thames there. And we stayed there for 5 years in that place, and it was the most idyllic childhood I'll ever have. We used to watch the fighters and Spitfires and dogfights and all that from the beautiful grounds there. And then when we got five, we got too old for the place, so we had to be sent away. Well, our mother never wanted us back, never saw us. We never saw her since then, so we never knew who she was. Anyway, then we got sent to children's homes, Dr. Monardo's homes, in the Bournemouth area. Some were really good homes, some were really bad homes, and really terrible, you know, so you go to a good home and it's great, then you go to a bad home and really beaten, and oh, it was really, really bad upbringing. But we got all through that, and then one day we got a letter, or the home got a letter from the supposed mother saying, I would like you back to London. Well, in them days, if you got more housing points, you got a better chance of moving from your terrace place or your little slum area you lived in. You got a better chance of moving on. So she wanted both of us back because, in the meantime, my mother had two girls, and our father was in the army, and unfortunately he passed away in 1947. But anyway, so she didn't want us back. But when she wanted this house of boys to get out, she wanted us back. So we came back to London when we was 9 years old. Well, you can imagine from coming from lovely Bournemouth and all that area, and then coming back to the streets of Paddington where we lived, or where she lived. And oh my goodness, it was, because all the bomb damage was in London then, and it was horrific. And, you know, you go through all these smells and sounds, and you, as a young child, it was... So we arrived at the address, and it was a sort of terraced place, and all the streets, the back streets, they were terrible, absolutely like Charles Dickens days. This was in Paddington. And we went in, and she said, well, I'm your... Call me mother. And my twin brother said, well, I'm not calling you mother, because... In the homes, we had foster carers or house mothers, and they used to be our sort of mothers. Anyway, it was a two-bedroom place, a one-bedroom place, and a kitchen. So there was five living in the bedroom. And my twin brother, he ran away. He just couldn't stand it. He just, it was too much for him. But I'm more of a positive person. I thought, oh, well, things can only get better, hopefully. But the very first day I ventured out, I was set upon by, who are you? And, you know, and probably talking in this Bournemouth accent. So I knew they were going to try and beat me up. So I backed myself onto a back wall so they couldn't get me from behind. And I was trying to fight them off. And this lady came out of a broom and whacked them and said, leave me alone, you know, you cowards. Anyways, that was my first initiation of being in that panic. But you had to survive, so you started to be able to look after yourself. Because I wasn't big then, but I thought, well, I've got to fight my way out of this.
That positivity and that sort of fighting spirit really does, I mean, you evoke it very strongly through all the chapters of the book. And, you know, we follow you through your life and your career. It has set you up very, very well for what's happened to you later in life when you've lost your sight.
Well, Roman, you're absolutely right. And being positive, my twin brother is a bit negative in things, and me being positive. So what happened with my sight loss is I still play table tennis, believe it or not, for the Milton Keynes League, up there, you know, in the league. And I can't see the ball too well, but I still love playing. Anyway, I was driving back for about 4 years ago from a place in Kingston in Milton Keynes. So I was driving back to my home, and I got in the car, and I thought, they've dimmed the lights on the highway. You know, I thought, the council have dimmed the lights. Oh, they're saving money. Oh, well. So I got home, and I always have a cup of tea and a bit of toast and put the television on. I thought, hold on, that's a bit distorted. Oh, dear, there's some problem here. So one of the table tennis teams was a team of doctors. One was an eye surgeon, and the other was a general surgeon. So I got in touch with the eye surgeon. He said, well, come down. I went private. And he said, well, John, he said, he examined me all that. I said, I've come to give you a return match. But anyway, he said, John, you've got a triple whammy here. You've got macular degeneration, which is dry. He said, you've got glaucoma, and you've also got cataracts. He said, you've got a triple there. I said, yeah, but you've got to face these things. And I thought, oh, well. But I've just still carry on, and gradually getting every year, you can see they're getting slightly less vision on them, you know. But
and was that what prompted you to write the book?
I was 70 when I wrote the book. It's only my nagging daughters do. She said, Dad, you've got to put all these adventures in a book. And I said, okay then. So I wrote the book at 70. I'm now 78. Coming on to 79, the 20th of March, I'm still hanging on to my 70s, but by my fingertips. The sight loss and all that is not in that book because it only happened 3 years ago when I was, say, 75.
Was there a memoir that inspired you to write? Was there somebody you wanted to write like?
Well, what it was, I used to be in the sprinkler system game, you know, and I started my own business with a friend, and I was about 30 years ago, this was, and I was in Hemel Hempstead. I live in Milton Keynes now, but in Hemel Hempstead, I was working in a warehouse, and he had to go on another job that day, and I was on my own. So I climbed this high tower, and it was about 30 foot up. And to rush around, so to come down quick, you should go through the centre of the tower. But I came at the outside of the tower with a pair of stilts in my hand, and unfortunately, someone had a forklift, and they bashed into the tower as I was coming down. Well, that vibrated all the way up to the top. Of course, I only had one hand on the rail, the other hand with a pair of stilts on. I went flying off, and I thought, oh, my goodness, this is the end of me. And you're just floating through the air, and you just hear a crash and bang, and that's it. But anyway, I went to him and I started, I broke my leg, broke my arm. But I think I've got away with it a bit because I'm quite light. And anyway, when I was in the hospital, I thought someone gave me a copy of a book, and I'd never read a book in my life. And this was the first book. It was a book called Papillon. Dustin Hoffman was in it. And it was in, they used to send, it looked like Devil's Island. They used to send all the French prisoners to that place. And when I was reading the book, I thought, my goodness, he's explained this so well. And he was escaping, him and his colleague escaped from this Devil's Island, and they were running through the jungle. And I was absolutely with this guy. I thought, I'm so with him. I wanted him to do well, I wanted him to escape. And then that was my first book that I ever read. And then when my daughter said, well, Dad, put all these memoirs in a book. So, and I thought, if I could only get that, Dustin Hoffman film, I could get that and let the reader know how I'm, and put the reader with me, And I think I've done that in the book. And it was very. My niece said, I said to my niece, how did I explain that to. I didn't have a good education. So I said, how did I explain that to people? She said, do you know what? It's like having a video camera on your shoulder. We're with you all the way. As you walk into a place, I know what you're doing because you've explained it. And I was very pleased about that. Yeah, I was quite happy with it.
It rattles along at a great pace. John Banfield, thank you so much for being a guest on Read On, and good luck with the writing career.
Well, thank you very much. All the best then.
The blow was such a stunner that it was 13 years before I could get back on my feet again. It was not the usual kind of blow either, and they clubbed together to let me have it. This was the 26th of October, 1931. At 8 in the morning, they had taken me out of my cell in the conciergerie, the cell I'd been living in for the past year. I was well-shaved and well-dressed. I looked as smooth as they come in my made-to-measure suit and white shirt with a pale blue bow tie to add the finishing touch. I was 25, and I looked 20. The gendarmes were rather impressed by my posh clothes, and they treated me civilly. They even took off the handcuffs. There we were, all six of us, the five gendarmes and me, sitting on two benches in a bare room. A dreary sky outside. The door opposite us must lead to the Assize Court, for this building, this Paris building, was the Palais de Justice of the Seine. In a few moments, I was to be indicted for willful homicide. My counsel, Maître Raymond Hubert, came in to see me. There's no solid evidence against you. I fully expect us to be acquitted. That us made me smile.
Robert Gladwell narrating Papillon by Henri Charrière, which is TB1371. Thanks to John Banfield. As he says, his autobiography, My Life, My Work, My Poems, is available as a paperback or e-book from Amazon. And his hidden gem, Papillon, by Henri Charrière, is available from the RNIB Library in Braille and as TB1371. Do you have a favourite book in the RNIB Library that you'd like to share? Or maybe you found a hidden gem that might expand my literary horizons? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now, before we return to Marion Rankin for the books of her life, Lucy Worsley is a historian and presenter well known to those who enjoy history documentaries on the TV or radio. As a curator of the royal palaces, she also has a keen interest in what buildings reveal about those who lived in them. And this interest lies at the heart of her new biography of Jane Austen, as she told RNIB reporter Claire Carson at the Cheltenham Literature Festival.
Yes, it's called Jane Austen at Home, and the clue is in the title. It's about the different places, the different buildings in which she lived. And if you've seen feature films about Jane Austen's, well, of Jane Austen's novels, you might have the idea that she lived in magnificent mansions. But that isn't the case at all. She lived in a succession of sometimes quite small, sometimes rather depressing houses, a rented flat. And I went and visited all of these places, because I think that once you know this, you can get a new understanding of her books, of her novels.
Tell us how you became involved in Jane Austen.
Well, I'm a historian of things. There are historians who work primarily from documents and written sources, but I've always really liked the way that food or clothes or music or architecture can act like a little wormhole to take you back into the past, the nitty-gritty, dirty detail, if you like, of people's lives. And my real job, what I actually do all day, is work as a museum curator. I'm the chief curator at Historic Royal Palaces. So we look after grand royal palaces. But I've always been a complete Jane Austen lover as well. So when I realised that this important anniversary was coming up, this year it's 200 years since she died, I thought I could use my approach as an architectural historian to her life. And I just had the best time doing it.
What was one of the most interesting things that you found out about her?
Well, it's hard to know where to begin, really. I had a sense of this, but I didn't really understand just how financially precarious her life was. So I'm not saying that she lived a life of struggle for food or anything like that. No, she wasn't on the streets. But her family came from a level of society that's called the pseudo-gentry. I quite like this term. It means you want to be part of the landed gentry, but you don't actually have any land. So there's a certain amount of make-do and mend and keeping up appearances. And at this level in society, it's inappropriate for women to earn money. You weren't supposed to just go out and get a job as a woman. You were supposed to marry money, which is something that Jane didn't do. And I think that one of the reasons that she didn't do it is because she thought she could glimpse that maybe it was possible for her to make her living as a professional writer, that she was just beginning to do when, at the age of 41, she died. It's utterly tragic.
But it is interesting that she was going against that which was expected of her. So from the films, like you say, we've got a picture that she's living a charmed life in a big house. But the reality is that she was very hardworking and chose to live in a small cottage and work hard and not marry. Tell us a bit more about her relationships.
Well, the crunch moment came when she was approaching what she herself calls the years of danger. So, right, when you're 27, when you're 28, if you're a Georgian spinster in the gentry, you're getting really worried. You're just about to get left on the shelf. And when she's at this age, she did panic, and she did sort of accept, well, she did accept a very good offer from a man who had a proper mansion. He was kind of like Mr. Darcy, but obviously he didn't have Mr. Darcy's kind, redeeming, talented, clever, brilliant qualities. And the next morning, she woke up again and she thought, no, I just can't go through with this. And she broke it all off. So that's the point at which I think she thought, that life, which is expected for me, I'm going to turn down.
Very courageous.
Very courageous. And she ended up instead living with her sister, who, like her, was unmarried. And they had to live on little gifts, little handouts from their brothers, who were working. They were clergymen, they were in the navy, one of them was a sort of landed gentleman, and so they were living on the charity of their brothers in a little cottage. That there they had freedom, and there I think Jane had creative freedom, and that's where she got on and she produced her late great books, which are Mansfield Park and Emma and Persuasion. And I think that there's an underlying message in all of these books, which are on the surface really beautiful, frothy, pleasurable, life-enhancing romances, but underneath the books say, isn't it terrible that women are put into this position where they have to marry money? That's my belief.
So she was possibly quite hard up through her life. Did she have any sense, do you think, that her books would be so successful?
You got to define hard up quite carefully, because she was never hungry. Her concerns were more like having the right thing to wear, having the freedom to spend her time as she wished, because it was expected that she would spend a lot of time, A, looking for a husband, B, sucking up to rich people who might give her legacies, C, acting as a childminder for her 33 nieces and nephews, which she had, because obviously if you've got a maiden aunt, well, you get her to look after the kids, don't you? So she had those kind of restrictions on her life. And this pseudo-gentry thing was one of the reasons that when she did publish her books, she was successful later on in her life, her name wasn't on the cover, because her family, you know, they weren't totally comfortable with this. So by the time she died, nobody knew who Jane Austen was. She never saw the financial benefits of her brilliance, although she was starting to get a bit of money in.
And it made something like £600... through her life?
Yes, her lifetime earnings were in the region of £650. Now, what does that mean? It was quite a lot compared with what she'd had before, which was pocket money that her family gave her of £20 a year. She had to live on that, £20 a year. So £650 sounds like a lot. But when I tell you that for a Georgian professional man, like a solicitor, he would have expected to earn £650 in 6 months.
So how amazing that she is on the new £10 note. Now, there is a wonderful fact about the new £10 note that RNIB was consulted when the note was made so that it would be very accessible and understandable. And the third £10 note ever produced with Jane Austen's face on went to RNIB. First was the Queen, then the Prime Minister, then RNIB. So it's very precious, although even the image that we see on that, I understand, isn't quite possibly the right one.
May I say, I'm delighted she's on the £10 note. I'm really happy that she's there. But there is a sort of delicious irony that I think maybe she herself would have appreciated, which is that picture that's on the note isn't really her.
Scandal!
Well, it is what we would call a sort of airbrushed author publicity photo. That's what it is. It was produced after she was dead. She didn't have any say in it. And people who knew her looked at it and they said, yes, that's a sweet and pleasing face, but it's really not much like the original. And
wow, interesting.
The original, as far as we can tell, does survive through a sketch that her sister made of her. And in it, you've just got a less pretty face. You've got someone who looks... Sometimes she's described as looking a little bit sour in the picture. And I do think she was a very funny, sharp, clever, sometimes bitter person. The sort of person who could have a good laugh about what's happened.
Some of her books took a long time to write, possibly even 10 or 20 years in the making. Can you help us understand why that was?
She had an interesting journey towards getting published. She started out writing to entertain her family. She had all these brothers and a sister. They lived in the countryside. There wasn't much to do in the evenings. So she would write stories and read them aloud to the group. And that's why Jane Austen novels sound really good. The dialogue in them is really good. They're like plays. It's one of the reasons that people find them easy to turn into films, because it's all about what the characters are saying to each other. So you can imagine her performing these stories to her family and honing them over time. And her father, who was a great supporter, when she was in her 20s, he sent off one of these books to a publisher who just turned it down flat. Now, that was kind of a boon, because she didn't, you know, we don't even know that she knew that he'd done this, actually. But either way, nothing came of it, but she went on trying and getting better. So if that early version of her work had been published, she might not have the reputation that she's got today, because she went on reworking that book until it reached its sort of mature form, and then it did come into the world after a long, hard slog on her part. And I think that the reasons that publishers couldn't see what was good about her books at first is because they were so unlike everybody else's books. There weren't any pirates in them. There weren't any ghosts or haunted abbeys. They were just they were so novel. They really were novels. They were entirely novel. And that's why it took ages for publishers to see what was good about them. Discerning readers saw what was good about them. But the whole thing did not catch fire until years after she was dead.
I love the image of everyone gathering round, you know, the dark evenings, the fire burning, the candles burning, to hear the stories read aloud. It's something magnificent about storytelling that possibly we lose a bit. Would that have been very typical of her age?
Well, I think it's kind of like, you know, today we sit in the room, there's a television in the corner, so one person on the television is entertaining numerous people through the technology that's available. They were just doing the same thing. One person would entertain the rest through the... And the price of candles actually comes into this. A lot of life comes down to funny little nitty-gritty details of domestic life. If you were pseudo-gentry, like the Austens were, you would not want to burn a lot of candles at night because they were expensive. So you'd light just one, and one person would read, and the others would sit in the dark and listen. And it was frugal.
So how did Jane Austen become so famous if her name wasn't on the cover of the book and people didn't really even know who she was until she died?
Well, after she died, her family thought, we're pseudo-gentry, we need some cash, what can we do? So they brought out in a sort of collected edition the novels that she'd published and the ones that she hadn't. And this is the first time her name was on the cover, and then it just grew from there, really.
Why do you think that Jane Austen is still so popular today?
Now, Jane Austen's Victorian readers, these are the people who first really took her to their hearts. They like to think of her as a good little woman, somebody called Saint Aunt Jane, who lived in the village and put together these nice little stories. And this is an image that's stuck, and it's an image that is wrong. If you just look at the physical form of her manuscripts, a little bit of her novel writing, a lot of her letter writing, you can see that it's messy and it's passionate and she goes over things. It's sometimes as if she's yelling on the paper. And today what people look for and find in Jane Austen is someone much more like us, somebody who cares, somebody who wants to be professional, somebody who wants to make money out of their writing. And the great thing about Jane Austen is that every generation comes along and they look at her work, and it is so infinitely flexible that they find themselves in it. So I'm saying this to you in 2017. In 10 years, somebody else will be saying, no, 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 you've got Jane Austen all wrong. She was like this. This is my Jane Austen.
Do you have a favourite character?
Well, I particularly like the story of Emma, which is it's quite an unpopular Jane Austen book because the heroine is a bit difficult to like. There's something a bit prickly about her. She's quite a proud person. I can't think at all why I like her. Obviously, she and I have nothing in common with each other.
Well, Lucy, thank you so much for talking to us. And I'm sure that Emma would have made a great historian.
She might have done, yeah. She had a very inquiring mind and she was very good at leaping to conclusions, which is a danger for a historian.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks to Claire Carson and Lucy Worsley. Jane Austen at Home is available in Braille, giant print and as TB24353. Lucy's book, If Walls Could Talk, A History of the Home, is available in Braille and giant print. And, of course, all of Jane Austen's novels are available from the RNIB Library in a full range of accessible formats. For more information, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB Helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB Helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Talking Books.
In the Talking Books Library.
With a frenzied, incoherent cry, the ship's surgeon fled the bridge. Within minutes, the entire ship was altered.
Star Trek, the classic episodes.
The library tapes on Cordrazine said that at such dosages, paranoia was a frequent outcome. But McCoy knew the ship too well. By the time a search was organized, he had reached the transporter room and beamed himself down to the planet the Enterprise was orbiting.
The adaptations of almost every single episode from the original series of Star Trek are available on audio from RNIB Talking Books.
Bones! He shouted. No! No! But he was in time only to see McCoy disappear into the cloudy octagonal frame, his body popping out of sight as though it had been swallowed.
There are three volumes mirroring the three seasons of the show. Volume 1 has the episodes from Season 1, including The Naked Time, Shore Leave, The Squire of Gothos, Space Seed, and The City on the Edge of Forever.
What are you?
Kirk said.
I am the guardian of forever.
Volume 1 is 23 hours 9 minutes long, and it's narrated by William DeVries. Volumes 2 and 3 are read by Hayward Morse. Volume 2 is 25 hours 20 minutes long. Volume 3 is 21 hours 49 minutes long and includes stories such as The Last Gunfight, The Empath, and Spock's Brain.
Damn you, Bones, talk. He was worse than dead. What do you mean? Jim, McCoy spoke pleadingly as though he were appealing for mercy from his own sense of helplessness. Jim, his brain is gone.
Star Trek The Classic Episodes, Volumes 1, 2 and 3 are available from the RNIB Talking Books Library. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk/talkingbooks.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now it's back to Marion Rankin for the books of her life. Marion, was there a book that you read as a child or a young woman that made you fall in love with writing?
Oof, I feel like that's asking me how to choose between my children. but there are. I'm going to pull it back to when I was sort of around 18 or 19. When I was a kid, I just read very widely and very indiscriminately, and I couldn't even pick out a single book. They all sort of shaped themselves into this wonderful literary landscape that I sort of immersed myself in as a child. But when I was about 18, one of my best friends shared her copy of Sylvia Plath's journals with me. And that particularly opened my eyes to the scope and possibility of writing, quite apart from being a blisteringly good writer. There's this passage in there where she takes, I think it's just the first line of a poem that she's been working on, and she just sort of deconstructs it word by word, almost, I think it's sort of in an attempt to explain to herself what it is that she's doing and analyze her own process behind it. And she sort of says, you know, I use this word here because it has this beautiful assonance with this previous word, and it's got all these layers of extra meaning to it. And that incredibly forensic approach to language and both the music of it and the meaning of it, that really opened my eyes to the possibilities of writing.
Unfortunately, Sylvia Plath's memoirs are not available from the RNIB library, but much of her other work is, including The Bell Jar and Ariel, which is TB22583. And is there a book that you'd like to curl up with on a rainy day when you don't have an umbrella in your hand and reread as comfort food?
Oh, there are so many. At the moment, I'm doing lots of research for my next book, so rereading is an absolute luxury. And the book I would most like to go back to at the moment is published a couple of years ago. It's Lucia Berlin's short stories. It's called A Manual for Cleaning Women. She was a writer based in the States who was very underappreciated during her life. She had quite a hard life in many respects, and that comes through in her short stories. But what she's absolutely brilliant at is capturing the beauty of small everyday moments and just writing about them in this absolutely gorgeous sense where she kind of lays the horror of life but also the mystery and wonder of it all together in the same story. It's an absolutely brilliant collection. I do really recommend it.
I hated St. Joseph's, terrified by the nuns. I struck Sister Cecilia one hot Texas day and was expelled. As punishment, I had to work every day of summer vacation in Grandpa's dental office. I knew the real reason was they didn't want me to play with the neighborhood children. I'm sure they also wanted to spare me Mammy's dying, her moaning, her friends praying, the stench and the flies. At night, with the help of morphine, she would doze off, and my mother and Grandpa would each drink alone in their separate rooms. I could hear the separate gurgles of bourbon from the porch where I slept. Grandpa barely spoke to me all summer. I sterilized and laid out his instruments, tied towels around the patient's necks, held the Stom Aseptine mouthwash cup and told them to spit. When there weren't any patients, he went into his workshop to make teeth or into his office to paste. I wasn't allowed in either room.
Manual for Cleaning Women by Lucia Berlin is available commercially in print, ebook, and audiobook versions. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the audience?
So one that really stuck with me was it's a book called The Sunlight Pilgrims by Jenny Fagan. It's sort of a follow-up to her debut novel, which is called The Panopticon, but I haven't read The Panopticon, so it's not one where you have to read the first one to read the second. It's set in a sort of apocalyptic Britain where this icy winter has descended and just there's no sign of it ever letting up. And it's very much about the relationships between people and the way life goes on, even in the midst of threatening doom, essentially, and the connections we forge between each other. Gorgeously written.
He presses his fists into his eyes and swallows down hard. Repossessors will clamp metal shutters over the foyer doors in about 10 hours, and he will not be here to watch them. No doubt it will only be a matter of months before wealthy city types move into a well-designed property with great original features right in the middle of Soho. They're doing it to all the businesses that go bust. He picks up a glass, wanting to hurl it with enough force that it could spin all the way through to the future. While the new residents walk around wearing unsubtle signifiers of wealth, the woman in another room would just hear a definite clunk one day as her other half took a tumbler to the head and slid perplexed, eyes glazed, down the wall. If he is here when the repossessors arrive with cutters, it won't end well. Dylan's footsteps echo in the empty building. He strides along corridors that hold memories from his childhood in each and every nook. It's all borrowed. Bricks, bodies, breathing. It's all on loan.
The Sunlight Pilgrims by Jenny Fagan is also available commercially in print, audio, and ebook formats from wherever you purchase your books. Marian Rankin, thank you so much for introducing me to the history of the umbrella and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you for having me.
Don't forget you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter @talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.